Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with strong words from Secretary of State John Kerry, characterizing the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime as undeniable, while calling its indiscriminate use against women and children and bystanders a moral obscenity. Rafif Shujati, the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, the umbrella group for the Syrian opposition, joins us to discuss the consequences for the Assads as the certainty that they use chemical weapons grows. Then, with groves of ancient sequoias in Yosemite National Park threatened by a raging wildfire, we will speak with a leading expert on forest fire prevention and management. Stephen Pine, the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University, joins us to discuss how policies preventing natural forest fires that make trees and forests healthier have led to a buildup of underbrush fuel that makes it all but inevitable that forests and trees will be killed by much more intense and catastrophic fires. Then finally, we'll look into the wave of legislative attacks on abortion providers at the state level that have shut down 54 abortion providers in 27 states since 2010. Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, joins us to discuss the dramatic decline of abortion access from Republican anti-abortion legislation under the guise of protecting the civil rights of the unborn and their mothers. And joining us now is Rafif Shujati, who's the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, the umbrella group of the Syrian opposition. She's a Syrian-American activist and works to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rafif Shujati.
Thank you, Ian.
And the Secretary of State appears to have removed any ambiguity on the part of the U.S. administration. The French and the British have already said that they believe this is chemical weapons were used by the Assad regime, and so have Médecins Sans Frontières. Do you think that the fact that the UN team that eventually did get in were fired on? Let's begin with that, because there's some ambiguity about that. Who do you understand fired on the lead vehicle? They shot out the tires and put a bullet through the windshield, and they had to, obviously the convoy had to stop and replace the vehicle. So what's your understanding on what happened there?
What we understand is that it was the popular committees that fired on the UN inspectors. The popular committees are made up of the Syrian Shabiha. These are the paramilitary forces that dress in civilian clothing and carry full weaponry. And in fact, these Shabiha have been guilty of torturing and detaining thousands, tens of thousands of Syrians. So we believe that they were the ones who were sniping the UN inspectors' vehicles.
And they would not be freelancers. This would be because the suspicion is that the Assad regime has delayed the inspectors getting in and have shelled the area fairly thoroughly, and that the purpose of doing this is to allow enough time for evidence to degrade.
Absolutely. The Shabiha are not freelancers. These are paid thugs, paid by the regime, in support of the regime. And what we do understand is that the whole area had been under pretty continuous shelling for 5 days, to degrade any evidence and to, in fact, from our perspective, to kill as many other people as possible.
So Bashar al-Assad, in an interview with a Russian newspaper, dismissed claims that his regime was behind the use of chemical weapons, pointing out that it would be illogical to do such a thing because it would invite, obviously, a foreign response, and one would hope a global response, since we're talking about weapons of mass destruction here. How do you explain his confidence that in other words, when he says it's illogical, he may have a point?
Well, yeah, he has behaved illogically from the beginning of the Syrian uprising. What we do need to remember is that he and his regime operatives and his armed forces control the chemical weapons stockpiles in Syria. And the other thing we have to remember is that he issued a threat. He said that there would be global consequences if the U.S. or any foreign power were to strike Syria. And so we have a psychotic dictator, a madman, who is now issuing threats to the whole world in addition to launching chemical weapons on civilian communities. So I think he is, in fact, quite illogical. I think he's a dangerous madman that needs to be stopped.
So if indeed he is attacked, which seems it's growing in likelihood, and whether or not my understanding is there's already a lot of evidence out there, at any rate, from Medecins Sans Frontières and others. There's a lot of pathological evidence that you can get from the victims of a chemical attack, even if the traces of sarin have evaporated. If the U.S. waits for a few days for the U.N. and whatever they come up with, I'm sure will indicate. It seems there's a lot of confidence on the part of the Western powers that something that chemical weapons are used. So I don't imagine that any evidence will change that. So the real question is, when will the U.S. and or other powers strike? And do you expect a retaliation? Do the Free Syrian Army expect a retaliation? They've been somewhat disappointed up to date.
Yes, I do want to clarify that we in the local coordination committees in Syria have been reporting the use of chemical weapons against civilian communities since December of 2011, and international players have been collecting evidence over time. With the latest strikes, they apparently have gotten enough conclusive evidence to justify a strike and for statements to be issued saying that, in fact, Obama's red line has been crossed. I think with Secretary Kerry's comments today, it's clear that the U.S. and other members of the international community are prepared to take action. The question is, what kind of action are they going to take, and will it be decisive? If they take action and don't cripple the regime or cause its collapse, then we have really gained nothing and, in fact, can expect an additional backlash and can expect the Assad regime to retaliate very harshly against civilians in Syria.
But we've spoken before, Rafif Jujadi, again, the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, the umbrella group of the Syrian opposition. We've spoken before, and you've said that essentially if the Assads go, then everything will be fine. And I spoke yesterday with the former CIA officer, Robert Baer, who spent a lot of time in the region and knows, and is in touch with both the Alawite side and the rebel side. And he says for the Alawites, it's an existential struggle, that they feel their backs against the wall. So with or without Assad, it won't change things. So let's start with that question.
Let's agree that it's an existentialist struggle for the regime. I would not paint it in such sectarian terms. There are a great many Alawites who are part of the Syrian revolution, which started for dignity and freedom and democracy for all Syrians, regardless of ethnic or religious background. Now, the fact that the Assad regime comes from that minority Alawite sect is more of a coincidence, but I would not paint it in sectarian terms. The Assad regime is a family that has treated this country like a family farm for the past 50 years. And much to their surprise, the people have finally risen up against tyranny and dictatorship. And this is where the problem lies. For the Syrian people to oust the Assad regime means an end to that family dynasty.
Well, what do you think caused them to resort to such a drastic measure as using chemical weapons, knowing that there'd be an international response? And we don't quite know what the response is going to be, but I think we can assume that something's going to be happening in the next few days.
Well, I think Assad has been greatly emboldened by the international community's paralysis. He has managed to displace more than 1.5 million people to neighboring countries, and he has managed to allow roughly 11 million of Syria's 22 million people to be subjected to famine. And we have more than 110,000 civilians killed. We have more than 250,000 people in detention. These are political prisoners. Many of them are children. And so Assad has been able to act at will with virtually no consequences, and he continues to enjoy the support of Hezbollah and Iran and the Russians. And so I suspect that he and his regime operatives are feeling so emboldened that they feel there are no consequences.
Well, specifically, there are reports that that Maher Assad's, his 4th Division, where they were launched from his headquarters at the base of Mount Qassoun, that's where the artillery, with the sarin shells are supposedly mixed with Iranian riot gas to dilute it so it's not that detectable. Now, that's one theory, that that Assad's brother just went off the reservation or did it on his own. The other theory is that Assad himself ordered it because very recently he was almost killed in an ambush. And the third theory is that the rebels in that neighborhood have advanced very, very close to into Damascus, while the regime has had successes with Hezbollah in Qusair and Homs. The Free Syrian Army and its allies, I guess al-Nusra and these other people, have made inroads into close to the heart of the regime. So walk us through those three scenarios.
So I have heard that it could have been Maher Assad, the brother and the commander of the armed forces from the 4th Division. I've also heard that this was from the Air Force Intelligence Branch and the 155th Armored Division. I've heard multiple different theories. But the bottom line is that anybody in a position of real military power in Syria is part of the Assad family. And so I believe the decisions to strike and to use chemical weapons will be made in a family context in full collusion. So whether or not this was Bashar Assad retaliating because of an attempt on his life, or whether he and his brother agreed to launch a chemical weapons strike against civilians, it would be one and the same. The end result is that we have had more than 1,000 people die due to a chemical strike. In terms of the attempt on his life, on Bashar al-Assad's life, yes, several days ago, the Free Syrian Army did attack a convoy that was transporting Bashar al-Assad. And I believe that there are attempts like this every day. I think the Free Syrian Army and other rebel forces will not stop until this is over.
So I'm just trying to get an understanding of what would provoke such what appears to be a reckless move. Now, you're suggesting that from the perspective of the Free Syrian Army and the local coordinating committees that you are the English language spokesperson for, that you've been disappointed by the West since this rebellion began and you're not expecting a lot. But assuming that at the very least and the most logical thing would be for the U.S. to shut down the main airport in Damascus. Would that's through which the Iranian supplies come in every day. Would that make a difference?
Well, conceivably that would make quite a difference because the Assad regime is relying on Iranian weapons and Hezbollah fighters to kill its own people. That would be helpful. But now that the regime has resorted to the use of chemical weapons, I think what we need is much more precision strikes. We need surgical strikes. We need to, the international community would need to take out the very heart of that command and control. I don't think shutting down an airport or two or three or nine is going to essentially restore any sort of peace to an area that's being subjected to the psychopathic whims of a family that possesses and deploys chemical weapons.
So in other words, your feeling is that if the U.S. and others who might get involved in a punitive response to the use of chemical weapons, not based upon the Syrian civil war, which they've been obviously ambivalent about, and as you point out, the Russians, then the Hezbollah and the Iranians are not ambivalent. They are completely supporting Assad. But they, but if they were to do something, it would have to be to stop this family from using these weapons again. And the only way that you do that would be to take out the entire command and control structure, which is a family-based system, right?
Well, that is what I believe. I think the time for negotiations and the time for nonviolence and all of the ideals to which we aspired have come and gone. Now that we're talking about chemical weapons and we're talking about very significant regional implications, and we're talking about different regional actors, and we're talking about a humanitarian crisis that has surpassed anything we've seen in Rwanda or Bosnia. So everything is being escalated, and I think if we want to put an end to this and restore any sort of stability, we do have to bring about the collapse of this regime and help bring about some democracy and restore order.
Well, just in closing, Rafish Jujati, given the record of ambivalence, would a punitive symbolic strike like blowing up the airport and cratering the runway, to your mind, that may even be worse than doing nothing? Because
absolutely. This would only antagonize Bashar al-Assad. This would be very provocative, I think, for the Russians, for Hezbollah, for Iran. I think it would signal that the red line of chemical weapons is really just a blushing pink line and is really meaningless. I have no idea what the international community would be aiming to achieve by blowing up an airport route. I think decisive surgical strikes are what we need.
Well, but decisive surgical strikes to take out the regime itself. That's what you're saying.
The regime itself, the heart of the command and control. Absolutely.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Rafish Jujati.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Rafish Jujati, who is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, the umbrella group of the Syrian opposition. She's a Syrian-American activist and works to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the massive fire in the Yosemite National Park and why it is happening.
اكتب واخط بالقلم بالقلم اكتب واخط بالقلم دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي يواسيني.
I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Pine, who's an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of forest fires. He is the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pine.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
And my understanding, Stephen, is that over the years, for reasons I'm not entirely sure, that the policy of the Forest Service has been to prevent the natural forest fires that make trees and forests healthier, and that this has led to a buildup of underbrush fuel that makes it all but inevitable that forest fires and forests and trees will be killed by much more intense and catastrophic fires like the one that we're witnessing now in Yosemite.
Well, that's about a third right, but that's a common perception. First of all, many ecosystems are adapted to fire, but they're adapted to a particular pattern of fire. So the critical thing is not whether you have fire or not, exclude fire or introduce fire. It's the way it's done, just as things are adapted to patterns of rainfall, not just to rain. That's part of it, and we adopted a policy of fire exclusion directly and indirectly for a long time. We tried that, and that allowed all the stuff to simply keep growing and building up. But again, it depends what that growth means. Just adding biomass doesn't add fuel. What the fire requires is small stuff, the grasses, the twigs, the branches, the shrubs, the stuff that can go very quickly. So even after a very large fire goes through a mature forest, most of the biomass is still standing. You see all these dead snags. What burned off were the needles and so forth. So it's not just that because you kept fire out, you automatically get more fuel. In many cases, that's true, but not everywhere. And the other part of that equation is that for 50 years, primarily following the trauma of the 1910 fires, the Forest Service in particular did everything it could to remove fire from the landscape, to suppress it, to keep it as contained as possible in their managed forests. And the last 50 years, the country, the federal agencies have been trying to find ways to put fire back in some benign way. They're still committed, of course, to fighting the fires we don't want, but they recognize we have to encourage or light the fires that we do. And it's how to actually make that happen has been the problem. But it's not a new idea. For over 40 years, the National Park Service has had official policy to restore fire. The Forest Service for about 35 years. This is not a new concept. The difficulty has been actually implementing it on the ground.
Well, my understanding, Stephen Pine, as it relates to the giant sequoias, that apparently there's a couple of groves that are threatened, and that these, of course, are amongst the Earth's largest and oldest living things, and that they can resist fire, and that fire actually helps them to break open the cones and spread the seeds. But if you have the kind of fire that's happening now in Yosemite, which they call a crown fire, that it goes across the tops of the canopies and burns the leaves and canopies, that's catastrophic. So a fire that comes along the ground that burns the brush and stuff, and that's the good fire, and the one that goes across the tops generated by massive winds is the bad fire. Am I on the right track here?
You're on the right track, but again, you have to vary it by, you know, the different species and habitats. Sequoias, ponderosa pine, interior Doug fir, many kinds of species, longleaf pines in the south, do very well with routine surface fire. They need it, even hot surface fire. They thrive in it. It encourages them, and in some of them, as with the sequoias, it's necessary to sort of liberate the seeds and then create an ash bed that the seeds thrive in. All this is perfect. The problem is when you change the kinds of fires, and what you're describing is exactly the potential threat to these sorts of groves, but it's also true for all the kinds of forests we have that used to have surface fire and don't. But there are also other kinds of forests for which the natural fire is a crown fire, that they simply every 80, 200, maybe 400 years, they have these immolating fires that go through the crowns and seem to destroy everything, but in fact is part of the regenerative process. So it's not just that all crown fires are bad, some are good. You just don't want crown fires next to sequoias and suburbs.
Which is what you have now, right, in Yosemite?
Well, that appears to be, we certainly have, it seems to have part of it. And I don't have any special details on the Yosemite fire, but it does seem to be potentially threatening the groves. It's certainly threatening communities. And we can only hope that those communities and the agencies responsible for managing the groves, you know, have cleared out some space, have years ago begun the process of preparing to accept fires and to be resilient against them. And they can certainly tolerate fire. They just can't take the kind of fire that may be coming their way. We'll just have to see.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pine, who's an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of forest fires. He's the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. So are we at a situation now, though, because of these fires, and they seem to be happening more frequently, and I understand that back in, 2000, that big fire outside of Los Alamos in New Mexico, that was even started, I believe, by an attempt to burn the underbrush that ran,
that's right,
got out of control and caused enormous fire, and on the scale of what we're seeing now, perhaps even worse. And I talked to somebody today from New Mexico in charge of the Valle Caldera Reserve, and she was already up in Montana fighting a fire. So
yep. Well,
they're happening all over, right?
Well, it's mostly in the Northwest and along California right now, and you know, it up until now it had not been an exceptional fire season. The fires were going where they usually go at the times they usually happen. The interest in the fire season was the homes destroyed in the Black Forest Fire in Colorado a year after Waldo Canyon had burned, and then, of course, the Yarnell Hill Fire tragedy that swept over a crew. But before that, the number of fires in the acres burned was actually below average. Now it's moved where it does this time of year, into the Northwest, the Northern Rockies, northern parts of California. That's the time. It's just that everything seems to be aligned perfectly in this area, and everything's exaggerated. So there's nothing unusual. It's just that it's all coming together with special force and intensity.
But in terms of the Forest Service's funding, my understanding is it's all having to go to firefighting as opposed to fire protection.
The funding thing, not unexpectedly, is a mess. And it's been getting worse for the last 20 years because it's costing more to fight fires, partly because you're having to protect a lot of structures and so forth, which are not part of, say, the National Forest or Park Service or BLM mission. But we're having to they're being responsible for protecting places along their perimeter or within their holdings. That's costing more. The technology is costing more. And Congress used to supply a supplemental funds at the end of the year to make up the difference. So you could not predict in advance how much fire season would cost. So you would spend what you needed, Congress would make up the difference, and things would go along. And there was a pile of money from the timber sales that allowed for a constant flow of money, so you didn't have a crunch. The timber sales are gone. Congress doesn't want to pay in the same way. There have been efforts to reform it, to create a pot, but that, again, anticipates how much you're going to have, and you can't predict that. And so then they're very angry when you spend more, but what? They're going to spend less? They're going to say, hey, we don't have any money. Too bad. Congress won't allow that, not if it's in their district. So, you know, the whole political paralysis we're seeing in other areas, why should fire be exempt from that? And it isn't. It's caught up with all the other issues and stuff. So, but it's not simply a case of not having enough money. We could have twice as much money, and we're not going to stop these fires. What we need to do is to take, we created, in effect, an ecological insurgency by our suppression policy early on. And it took decades for that to become apparent. And now the only way you're going to get control over those fires, you're going to have to take control of the countryside. You've got to manage how you live on the land, how you handle your houses and communities, your zoning, your building codes. You've also got to decide what kinds of practices you'll allow so you can treat this land so that it can tolerate fire. It can thrive under fire. It can absorb fire. So we don't have to spend billions of dollars. We don't have to lose lives. We don't have to do the kind of stuff we are now. In effect, it's not unlike our national health care system. We've got lots of money and fabulous emergency medicine, but we can't do the basics. We seem unable to handle that. And this is the equivalent. It's on a huge scale. We can't fix all of it. But we can begin rolling back some of the issues. We can certainly harden the assets that we want protected. We know we can do that. We're not going to be able to fight fires on these scales. They're just too big. The perimeter's enormous. And you can't tear up the landscape trying to stop them. And you can't put crews at risk recklessly under these extreme conditions. So we've got to be able to give these fires some more room, but we have to be able to tolerate that.
And how much, Stephen Pine, is the encroachment of homes into these forests and into these wilderness areas a part of the problem? In other words, is that because if the priority of protecting property seems to be greater than the priority of protecting the forests themselves, right?
That's right. But the issue then becomes, do you put your effort on the property itself, or do you put your effort trying to stop the fire so that it doesn't hit the homes? And right now, we've defined it as a wildland problem. We need to attack the fire to protect the homes, and we find ourselves unable to do that. And in fact, the homes can survive with basic treatments, and preventative measures and so forth. And there is a move to say, really, the responsibility resides with the homeowners, with the communities, with protecting, making their houses defensible and resilient, if you will. So, but that is a huge black hole in the whole fire story, and it's absorbing more and more resources and effort. And in some ways, there's a certain dismissiveness about it, I think, in much of the country because, well, the story is these people are stupidly moving their homes to where the fires are. But we haven't talked about climate change, and in some ways we don't need climate change for these big fires because we've got a climate otherwise we'd still have a fire problem. But if climate change develops the way people are predicting, what we're going to see is that the fires are going to move to where the houses are. That is, they're going to start moving to the east, and particularly to the southeast. And we may be seeing some of that already playing out in Texas. We're seeing others elsewhere. But that would be a real game changer. And then suddenly it's not just a quirky Western problem with retirees building these little exurbs where they shouldn't. It's going to be that the fires are going to come after us.
But in terms of fighting the fires, which is what we're witnessing now in Yosemite, apparently crown fires are really hard to fight, and that's what you're dealing with now, where the fire goes across the tops of the trees, the crowns, and sometimes at great speed, driven by winds that are increase as the fire itself increases. You have a kind of feedback loop there that creates these kind of tornado-type conditions. And the firefighters are on the ground, so the fire's going over the top of them. It seems that the only means are these airplanes dropping all of this fire retardant. Is that what we're
doing? Yes and no. We'd like to think that's true. The problem is that when you have the extreme winds and all the turbulence associated with the fire creating its own convective columns and that interacting with the winds, you mix all that up and dropping stuff from the air, dropping atomizing liquids from the air isn't going to be very effective. It's just going to get blown away. And it's not safe for the planes to fly. So when you have the extreme winds, exactly when conditions are worse, when you would like to most control the fire, you can't. Our aerial techniques are not effective. They're much more effective on small fires, preventing fires from getting large. You can do some stuff to strengthen fire lines in advance. But simply dropping this stuff on the fire under those conditions is not very effective.
And again, Stephen Pine, author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of forest fires, and he's the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. What about, though, the climate change in terms of changing the climate, particularly in the Southwest where it's getting hotter and drier? It's pretty hard to deny that we're having more and more dramatic and damaging weather events.
Well, I tend to agree, but it's really hard to identify particular fires or particular fire seasons with climate change. And that's especially true in the Southwest because we have a documented history of mega droughts. I mean, what we've seen now is not as bad as what we've had in the past. I mean, 1,000 years ago, 800 years ago, in the record. So we're prone to droughts. We're prone to these conditions. Climate change may very well be part of the mix, but gosh, we would still have a terrible fire problem even without it. So I think what we may be seeing on the climate change issue are all the secondary effects, not just temperature and magnified weather systems, but the effect on insects, beetle epidemics, diseases, other kinds of stresses on vegetation that make them more prone to burn or damage them. And this kind of thing, you're getting a kind of synergy, maybe. So it's a little more subtle set of interactions. Because fire, these big fires are not the equivalent of melting icebergs. I mean, if you've got melting glaciers, it's just a mechanical process. You heat it, it melts. But if you heat, you apply the same weather system to a landscape, and it's got to be refracted through all this biological system. Mm-hmm. And that's very complicated, and it's going to react in many, many ways. A lot of variability built into that. And then you put people on top of it, we've got social systems that also interact. And so suddenly it's not a mechanical process that if we have climate change, we've got to have these big fires. No, these are the result of land use changes. They're the result of how we manage fire, or they're the legacy consequences of stuff we've done and not done, and climatic effects, some of which may be new in the form of global warming and some of which may be similar to what we've had in the past.
Well, but the idea, when you talk about hundreds of thousands of years of data on climate, I understand that those trees that are being threatened now, those groves of sequoias, how old are those trees? They're all, some of the oldest living things on the planet, aren't they?
Well, yeah, they're among that. They're probably 2,000-3,000 or more years. I'm not an expert. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of evidence. I mean, in some ways, it's remarkable that they even exist. I've always marveled. They're sort of a Pleistocene relic. It's like finding a giant ground sloth or something.
Right.
But how did they survive? And the earliest accounts we have is that they were burned over basically every year. But there was not very much on the ground to burn. They were just grassy. They were giant cathedral groves, these huge columns. And because they were burned over, primarily by people, they existed in a landscape that prevented the kind of crown fire, these really dense forest-sustained crown fires, from sweeping through them. So, in a sense, human fire practices may have been part of what spared them from succumbing, like all the other megafauna and megaflora.
Right.
The Pleistocene. I don't know that, but it seems to me at least plausible.
Well, we can only hope that it survives.
They're irreplaceable, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
They really are. And it would be tragic, and it would be hard to justify why didn't we take steps to protect them. And I don't know what they've done or not done. I can't speak to that. But they've certainly been aware
right.
that this is a threat. And I assume they have over the years been doing things to help protect those groves, let them survive this kind of fire.
Sure. Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Stephen Pine.
Well, you're welcome.
Again,
for the invitation.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pine, an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of forest fires. He's a Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the number of abortion clinics that have closed due to state legislation.
Irate.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jody Jacobson, who's editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check and a longtime leader in the health and development community and an advocate with extensive experience in public health, gender equity, human rights, environment, and demographic issues. She previously served as founder and executive director of the Center for Health and Gender Equity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jody Jacobson.
Thank you for having me.
And it seems as though this new renewed Republican war on women is taking a dramatic toll on the number of abortion clinics in the country. And that appears to be the latest strategy, since the so-called pro-life community seem to be very, very creative in all kinds of ways they assault Roe v. Wade, which obviously stands in the way of banning abortion outright, but they seem to have found all kinds of ways around the edges, and they seem quite relentless. And it seems to me that if in the last, 54 abortion providers across 27 states have shut down, terminated abortion services in the past 3 years, it would indicate that this strategy is working.
Yes, Ian. Well, I mean, I think your word relentless is really captures well what's been happening. There's been a relentless assault on women's health services writ large, family planning, access to cervical cancer, breast cancer screening, and so forth, in addition to access to safe abortion care. And, you know, let's make no mistake about it, that is the goal, to eliminate access to safe abortion care and other forms of health care, primarily focused on women's ability to control whether and when they have children. So there's no mistake that these clinics are closing, that access to family planning is diminishing. And the means through which the far right has been accomplishing this, of course, you know, it's the Tea Party, it's the GOP, it's the ultra-religious groups. The means through which they're doing this is a set of spurious laws that have nothing to do with safety or health care or anything like it, although they fly the banner of women's safety and, you know, health care as a sort of misleading reason for why they're doing all of these things.
Well, quite a lot of it's quite Orwellian, because almost all of these state laws designed to make abortion next to impossible are couched in all kinds of women-friendly and child-friendly way, the latest of which, of course, is mitigating against fetal pain. But tell me about, it looks as if this horrible guy in Pennsylvania, this guy called Kermit Gosnell, who really was an anomaly, something out of a horror movie, the anti-abortion people jumped all over that case. And apparently they've had quite an effect, and at the state level. And you, your organization, Jody Jacobson, RH Reality Check, have obtained 38 states' responses to these group of House Republicans who've written letters to the health departments and the attorney generals in all 50 states. So walk us through what's going on there in terms of capitalizing on this anomaly with this horrible guy, Gosnell, and really, you know, apparently they're on a roll with this.
Yeah, let's remember that the war on access to health care started long before Kermit Gosnell became sort of a public figure, before anyone knew that he really existed. Well, people knew that he existed, but the Pennsylvania Department of Health did very little about him, nor did the anti-choicers for that matter, but that's another story. He was and is a criminal. He was providing illegal care, if you could call it that. What he did was, you know, absolutely detrimental to women. And he also was charged and found guilty of murdering an infant born alive. So there's no question that the man is a criminal. What he was doing was already illegal. So there's no relationship between Kermit Gosnell and safe providers. That's the first thing to realize. But yes, of course, as you noted, anti-choicers use any and all methods, whether they're true or not, to undermine access to health care. So they stirred up a, you know, public panic that now we've seen the real face of abortion care, it's Kermit Gosnell, so on and so forth. And in their quest to find other Kermit Gosnells, which apparently they were convinced they would do, The House Republicans on two committees, as you noted, Energy and Commerce and Judiciary, wrote letters to the state's Attorney General and Departments of Health. We've now received responses from all but four states, and there is absolutely not a shred of evidence for any of the contentions being made at the state level in any of the states. For example, there's, you know, widespread misinformation about the lack of safety at abortion clinics. And there's widespread contention by the far right that there's not enough regulation of abortion clinics. Well, what we found in the reports from the states themselves, including states like Texas, which just passed a draconian law, that they've had very little to no complaints about abortion care, that abortion care is more highly regulated than any other form of health care of equitable safety or risk. So in other words, it's normally over-regulated in many ways, not that anybody is against safe regulations, but there are regulations and then there are regulations meant to put you out of business. And that's what most of these newer regulations that have just been passed are meant to do. But having been passed, there's no evidence whatsoever that they were needed. So if you recall, for example, during the filibuster in Texas of the Texas law that was led by Wendy Davis, many of the Democrats asked repeatedly, where is the evidence for these restrictions? And they were met with silence. Well, because the state of Texas has no evidence, nor do at least 46 other states, for any of these kinds of things that are going on.
Again, I'm speaking with Jody Jacobson, the editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check. She's a longtime leader in the health and development community and an advocate with extensive experience in public health, gender equity, human rights, environment, and demographic issues. She previously served as founder and executive director of the Center for Health and Gender Equity. So using the Kermit Gosnell anomaly, the anti-abortion forces in the country, in cahoots with the House Republicans, have gone on this sort of jihad to protect the civil rights of newborns and their mothers. And as you pointed out, sending out this inquiry to all of the health departments and attorney generals of all 50 states, and now finding that there's no problem there. That hasn't stopped, as you point out, what just happened in Texas. My understanding, though, what happened in Texas was that the governor, Perry, is getting the best of both worlds there. He's able to be righteous and appeal to his religious right base by being a champion for good right-wing Christian values. And at the same time, his sister is the chief lobbyist for the companies that are going to benefit most from this change in the law, which basically makes it impossible for abortion providers to operate, because the new law demands an extraordinary level of medical equipment, et cetera, which would bankrupt them all, but is readily available in these small community hospitals that Governor Perry's sister represents. So is that what's going on here, that he gets blessed by God and his sister gets rewarded by mammon?
Well, I don't personally have evidence that that his family will or will not benefit. We're looking into that more. It's true what you've just said. The question is whether or not those centers would in fact offer any abortion care, and that's a big question. But it's worth looking into, and we have been looking into that. The fact is that Perry fashions himself as, you know, wanting to be a bigger figure. He's got to throw red meat to the very far right to do that. He's been certainly paid off for his campaigns by many of the people for whom he fronts on these issues. So I really think that Rick Perry has no soul, frankly, to be able to...
By the way, Jody, he may not have a brain, too. I mean...
Well, that's a different story, but...
Based upon his debating skills in the Republican primary...
Yeah, his debating skills left something to be desired, that's for sure. But, he's one of these people who is doggedly determined to eliminate care no matter who it affects. And, you know, one thing I just want to go back to, which is that none of the evidence that we've collected and made public had been made public before last week. So in Texas, while the State Department of Health and the State Attorney General may have known there was no rationale for these laws that they just passed earlier this summer, they weren't telling anybody else that. I think that the documents we've collected now will have an effect on the public debate as we go forward, because every time the far right tries to claim that there's evidence for, you know, a rash of infants being born alive and killed, well, there's no such rash of such a terrible thing happening anywhere in the United States, for example. And so you have now a treasure trove of evidence that I think will be able to be used in court cases and in various places. That doesn't sort of obviate the fact that we are now in a position where many bad laws have been passed, and it's going to be up to the courts to undo them unless and until more progressive forces take back those legislatures.
Well, that's certainly a heavy lift, I imagine. You know, certainly in terms of taking back the House is a heavy lift because of gerrymandering. At the state level, I don't imagine there's a parity in money in terms of, so it will require activism, because you've got the people like the Koch brothers and ALEC buying up all of these Republican legislators. So that would be a heavy lift. But are we heading into a kind of two different universes within the United States in terms of the red and the blue states? So could you have a situation, for example, in a lot of these red states, that young women who get pregnant, or even married women that simply can't afford to have any more children, that they are going to have to take Greyhound buses hundreds of miles to other states, and maybe at some point or other we'll have Christian vigilantes at Greyhound bus stations checking people's papers? I see a very dark future here for the United States.
I absolutely agree. That's already happening, in fact. We've already seen in Texas, for example, there's data on this, that women are crossing the border into Mexico to buy medical abortifacients. Now, whether they're buying drugs that are safe or not, they are buying, you know, medications to take their bodies back from the government. Now, if you're really worried about women's safety, you wouldn't be making the situation such that women are going over the border into Mexico to find abortifacients. So women's safety is really not at the center of any of this. We're already seeing women, of course, in places like North Dakota, South Dakota, where there's one clinic available, either crossing state lines or, as you said, you know, taking buses multiple nights away from home, added expenses in terms of childcare, days off of work. You know, add to all of the distance issues these things like mandatory counseling. Talk about Orwellian. You know, there are states in which doctors are not, you know, are well within their legal rights now to lie to patients if they see a fetal anomaly that they think that patient might consider abortion. So they can lie about that fetal anomaly. This is really a horrific situation, and if it were in any other field of health care, we wouldn't stand for it.
So it seems to me, Jody Jacobson, that if our politicians can't step up to the plate, level the playing field here and stop this assault, and after all, you know, the polls indicate still a majority of people in the country, I think, support a woman's right to choose, do they not? I mean, where does that stand?
Well, you know, I think reading of polls on these issues is very fraught with problems, because many of the polls ask questions like, are you pro-life? Are you pro-choice? It's a very simplistic framing. If we took at face value that all the people are anti-choice, that the anti-choice movement claims are anti-choice, then we would have had a personhood amendment passed in Mississippi, for example, or in North Dakota, where it was on a ballot initiative, or in Colorado. So what you find is that when you dig deeper at the state level in public opinion and surveying and focus groups, et cetera, is that people may say they are quote-unquote pro-life, whatever that means, because certainly I feel like I'm pro-life, but they will say they're pro-life, but they will tell you, I do not want to decide for somebody else what their life should be like. I don't know that other person's situation. I am not in a position to judge them. And that's what you hear repeatedly in most of the more sensitive kinds of polls. And that's why you see, even in very conservative states, when these things go on the ballot measure, they are defeated. But it's the legislatures, because they are, in fact, as you said, being paid by the Koch brothers and the anti-choice community, that are passing these laws, irrespective of what people in their state feel.
But my understanding is, I was going to say, that short of our politicians on the left fighting the good fight and stopping this tide, then what seems to be filling the gaps here are these sort of, you know, a patchwork of women's charities across the country that seem to be stepping in and helping these women in need who have, you know, been put in a situation where, as you say, in Texas they have to go to Mexico and a lot of them have to get on Greyhound buses. There's a group, for example, called RAP, W-R-R-A-P, Women's Reproductive Rights Assistance Project, that sends money to women in need all around the country to do these right. various things. And I've noticed that a whole bunch of these charities have popped up. Is that what's happening now, that essentially charities have had to step in and in the absence of political organization and commitment?
Yes, absolutely. What you're talking about really is akin to the National Network of Abortion Funds, which have funds in many of the states. Across the United States, for example, the Lilith Fund in Texas, or the Texas Abortion Fund, the T Fund in Texas also, or the D.C. Area Abortion Fund. These are all very small-scale funds that collect money for women who are too poor to afford an abortion and are in desperate straits. So it's really not at this moment an answer to access, because the abortion funds themselves are staffed by volunteers. They are extremely under-resourced. They certainly help many women, but they are not going to be the answer in the current framework for the number of women that are losing access to safe abortion care and can't afford to, you know, get over all of those obstacles that you mentioned.
Well, Jody Jacobson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian. I really appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Jody Jacobson, who's editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check and a longtime leader in the health and development community and an advocate with extensive experience in public health, gender equity, human rights, environment, and demographic issues. She previously served as founder and executive director of the Center for Health and Gender Equity. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.